gained a lot of his old momentum by being the underdog. We sat there, four grown men, acting as if it could be true. At work, as ever, Election Day brings a loose feeling, all at ends. The employees of the prosecuting attorney's office, once a group of ward healers and hacks, have been discouraged throughout Raymond's tenure from active political involvement. Gone are the days of deputies selling tickets in the courtrooms to the PA's campaign outings. In 12 years, Raymond Horgan has never solicited a dime in donations, or even a minute of campaign help, from the members of his staff. Nonetheless, many of the administrative employees who came on before Raymond was elected have continuing political obligations to the party sponsors who secured employment for them. As part of the uneasy compact struck a decade ago with Bolcaro, Raymond agreed to give most of the PA staff Election Day off. That way the party types can do the party thing: knock on doors, distribute leaflets, drive the elderly, watch the polls. This year they will be doing that for Nico Della Guardia. For the rest of us, there are no established obligations. I'm in the office most of the day, first mate at the helm of this sinking ship. A few others are around, mostly lawyers working on briefs or trials or clearing up their desks. About 24 younger deputies have been delegated to work with the U.S. Attorney's Office on a vote fraud patrol. This generally involves responding to junk complaints. A voting machine won't work, someone's got a gun in the polling place, an election judge is wearing a campaign button or over-counseling elderly voters. I receive occasional updates by phone and answer press calls in which I dutifully report that there is no sign of tampering with the democratic process. Around 4:30, I get a call from LaPranzer. Somebody's propped up a TV set in the hallway right outside my door, but there is nothing to report. The polls won't close for another hour and a half. The early news is just happy talk stuff about the heavy turnout.
"He lost," Lip tells me. "My guy at Channel 3 saw their exit polls. He says Nico's gonna win by 8-10 points if the pattern holds."
Again, my heart plunges, my gut constricts. Funny, but this time I really believe it. I look out the window toward the columns of the courthouse, the flat, tarred roofs of the other downtown buildings, the rippled black waters of the river, which turns, like an elbow, 2 blocks away. My office has been on the same side of this building for almost 7 years now, yet the sight does not quite seem familiar. "All right," I finally announce solemnly. "What else?"
"Nothing," Lip says. "Just thought I'd let you know."
He waits.
"We still working on Polhemus?"
"You have something better to do?"
"No,"
he says. "No.
They come down here today to get all my reports for Morano," the police chief. "He wants to look 'em over."
"So?"
"Struck me strange, you know. His mother-in-law got stuck up at gunpoint 3 years ago. I don't think he looked at the reports."
"You'd understand that," I say, "if you had a mother-in-law." Lip takes my humor as intended, an offering, an apology for my impatience a moment before. "They're just trying to make sure Nico's is briefed." "Which is a joke," I say. "Molto's probably been getting copies of the police reports from the Steno pool."
"Probably. I don't know. Something didn't sit right. Schmidt come in here himself, real serious, you know. Like someone shot the president.
They just want to look good."
"I guess. I'm going over to the North Branch courthouse to finish up on those court files," Lip says, referring to the records we have been looking for since my visit to the 32nd District. "They promised they'd have the microfilm from the warehouse before 5. I want to get there before they send it back. Where are you tonight in case I come up with something?"
I tell him I'll be around Raymond's party, somewhere in the hotel. It's beside the point by now to rush back with investigative results, but Lip says he'll be stopping in anyway, more or less to pay his respects.
"The Irish," Lip says, "always run a real fine wake."
LaPranzer's estimate proves accurate. The band plays loud, the young girls who are always here are still full of that soft glow of eventfulness, with banners across their chests and campaign boaters balanced neatly on their hairdos. Horgan, everything says in lime-green Gaelic script. In the front, at either side of the unoccupied speaker's platform, 2 10-foot enlargements of the picture stand. I drift around the ballroom, spearing meatballs and feeling bad. Around 7:30, I go up to Raymond's suite on the 5th floor. Various people from the campaign are moving through the rooms. There are 3 trays of cold cuts and some liquor bottles on one of the dressers, but I decline the invitation to consume. There must be 10 phones in these 3 rooms, all of them ringing. All 3 local TV stations have projected DeLaGuardia, the winner, by now. Laren, Judge Little, comes by with a tumbler of bourbon in his hand, grumbling about the exit polls.
"First time," he says. "I've seen a body pronounced dead before it hit the floor."
Raymond, however, is sanguine. He is seated in one of the interior bedrooms watching television and talking on the phone. When he sees me, he puts the phone down and comes to hug me.
"Rojat," he says, my given name.
I know that this gesture has probably been repeated with 12 other people this evening, but I find myself deeply grateful and stirred to be included in the grieving family. I sit by Raymond on the footstool of the easy chair he is occupying. An open bottle of Jack Daniels is on the candle table at the chair side, as well as a half-eaten sandwich. Raymond goes on taking phone calls, conferring with Laren and Mike and Joe Riley. I do not move. I recall the nights I used to sit beside my father while he watched a ballgame on TV or listened to the radio. I always asked his permission before taking a place next to him on the divan. They were the warmest moments that we had. As I became older, my father would drink his beer and occasionally pass the bottle to me. At moments, he would even make a remark aloud about the game. Eventually, the conversation begins to turn to the protocol of concession. Does Raymond communicate with DeLaGuardia first, or does he go downstairs to address the faithful? DeLaGuardia, they decide. Mike says Raymond should call him. Joe says send a telegram.
"Screw that," Raymond says. "The man's across the street. I'm going over there to shake his hand."
He asks Laren to make arrangements. He'll see Nico, make his speech, then come back up here to do one-on-one interviews with print and media reporters. No point in spite with them. He tells Max she should start scheduling those meetings around 9:30. He'll go live at 10 o'clock with Rosenberg. I have not noticed Mac until now. And when she turns her chair around, she says one word to me. Sad. Raymond asks to see me alone. We go into a dressing room, between the 2 bedrooms in the suite, nothing more than a large closet with a lavatory. How are you? I ask.
There have been things that hurt worse. Tomorrow will be bad, the day after. We'll survive. Listen, Raymond says. About what I mentioned the other night, when I see Nico, I'm going to offer to resign. I don't want any lame duck crap. I don't want to appear to be playing around with the office. I'd like to make a clean break. If Nico wants to run in the general election as an incumbent, let him. I'll tell him he's free to assume office, if the county executive approves. This is humor. Bolcaro is the county executive. Party chairman. Mayor. The guy has more titles than the leader of a banana republic. I tell Raymond he's made a wise decision. We look at each other.
I feel like I should apologize to you, Rusty, Raymond says. If there was any deputy I would have wanted to take over, you know it would be you. I should have tried to make that happen instead of running. The guys just pushed me so damn hard to give it one more shot.
I wave my hand, I shake my head. I prohibit his apology. Laren sticks his head in.
I was just telling Rusty, Raymond tells him. I never should have run again. I should have given him the shot. New face, career prosecutor, apolitical. Really could have revved things up, wouldn't you say?
Shit, says the judge. Pretty soon you'll have me believing it.
We all laugh. Laren reports on his conversation with DeLaGuardia's people. He talked to Tommy Molto, who has emerged tonight as the primary aide-de-camp. They'd rather not have a face-to-face this evening, Instead, Molto and Nico want to see Raymond in the morning.
10 o'clock, says Laren. He told me, didn't ask, and says, please make sure it's with Raymond alone. How do you like that, bossy little shit?
Laren takes a private moment with his discontent.
I said you'd call Nico to make a formal concession. When you're ready.
Raymond takes Laren's bourbon from him and has a belt.
I am ready, he says.
Loyalty goes only so far. I do not want to listen. I head back to the ballroom. Near the bar, I run into George Mason, an old friend of Raymond's. He is already drunk. We both are being jostled.
Pretty good crowd, he tells me.
Only near the bar, I think. But I save the thought.
He had a good run, George says. He did a good job. You guys should all be proud.
We are, I say.
I am. So what's with you? Private practice?
For a while, I guess.
Gonna do criminal stuff?
How many times have I had this conversation tonight?
I tell George, probably, I'll see. Who can tell? I'm gonna go on vacation, that's for sure.
George gives me his card and tells me to call. He may know some people I might want to talk to.
Horgan arrives in the ballroom 20 minutes later. The assholes from TV shove their way to the front, hold up their cameras and lights and boom mics so that you cannot see much.
Raymond is smiling and waving. Two of his daughters are with him on the platform. The band is playing an Irish jig. Raymond has said thank you for the third time, about halfway along to quieting the crowd, when somebody grabs my arm. Leprenzer. He looks harried from having had to push his way through to reach me. There is too much noise in here to speak, stamping, hooting, whistling. Some folks in the back have even started to dance. Leprenzer motions me outside, and I follow him beneath an exit sign. We end up, unexpectedly, in an alley outside the hotel, and Lip walks down toward a street lamp. When I see him now, I can tell that something's wrong. He looks almost caved in, compressed by some kind of worry. The sweat shines near his temple. From here, I can hear Raymond's voice inside, but not what he's saying.
This is too strange, Lip says. Something's fucked up over in the hall. It's way wrong.
Why?
I don't know, he says. But I'm getting vibes like I haven't had in years. I got a message. I'm supposed to be in Morano's office 8 o'clock tomorrow morning to be interviewed by Molto.
That's the message.
Not talk, not discuss. Interview, like they're after me. And here's another one. When I come back in tonight, they tell me that Schmidt took all the receipts for the evidence I've inventoried on Polhemus. Any questions, see him.
Sounds to me like you're off this case.
Sure, he says. Fine, but figure this in. I'm out in the North Branch before 5 o'clock. All of this hits by 6 o'clock, 6:30. And look at what I picked up out there.
He reaches inside his windbreaker to his shirt pocket. He has 4 or 5 sheets of foolscap, Xeroxes, I see, of court documents. The case number I recognize. It matches the complaint number missing from the 32nd District. The first sheet is a copy of the case jacket, People versus Leon Wells, a public indecency complaint, dismissed by court order a day in July 9 years ago.
Bingo, I say out loud. This page, Lip tells me.
It is the bond order. In our state, a defendant is permitted to satisfy bail in minor cases merely with his signature on a promissory note, promising to pay a sum, by law less than $5,000, in the event of his default. The only conditions are that he refrain from other crimes and report once weekly by phone to a member of the court's probation department. Leon's assigned probation officer, according to his bond slip, was Carolyn Polhemus. Her name and telephone number are right there.
Wait, here's the best.
He pulls the last sheet out. It is a copy of the court half sheet, a form dismissing the case. Motion to dismiss without prejudice, it is captioned. The attorney presenting the motion is the prosecutor, Raymond Horgan, Kendall County Prosecuting Attorney, by, is printed at the bottom of the form. The deputy handling the case is supposed to sign the blank. I cannot read the signature at first. Then I get it. Molto? Lapranzer and I stand a moment in the street lamps, looking at the papers again. Neither one of us says much. From inside, there's an enormous roar, then you can hear the band striking up again when Irish eyes are smiling. Raymond, I take it, has admitted defeat. I try to pacify Lapranzer. Hang tight, I tell him. We're not sure of anything. You take this. He gives me the copies from the court file. I move back toward the ballroom. Lip heads off alone, past the dumpsters and debris, into the darkness of the alley. Chapter 16. So we ended, I told Robinson. And we ended badly. 1 week she saw me less, the next week not at all. No lunches, no calls, no visits to my office. No drinks, as we so quaintly put it. She was gone. I knew she valued independence, and at first I tried to stanch my panic by telling myself it was only that, a show of freedom, best not to resist. But each day the silence worked on me, and my pathetic longing. I knew she was only one floor down. I wanted nothing so much as simply to be in the same room. I went 3 days running to Morton's third floor, where I knew she liked to go for lunch. On the third day she appeared, with Raymond. I thought nothing of that. I was blind then. I did not imagine rivals. I sat for half an hour by myself, shifting lettuce leaves across my salad bowl and gazing at a table 200 feet away. Her coloring, her hair. When the feel of her skin came over me, I sat alone in a public dining room and groaned. By the third week, I had passed the edge. I did not have to gather strength. I merely let myself go to impulse. I walked directly to her office, 11 o'clock one morning. I did not bring a file, a memo, any item for excuse. She was not in. I stood there on her threshold with my eyes closed, burning in humiliation and sadness, feeling I would die from being thwarted. While I stood there in that pose, she returned. "Rusty," she said, brightly. A chipper greeting. She pushed past me. I watched her bend to pull a file from her drawer. A parched arrow of sensation ran through me at the way her tweed skirt pulled across her bottom, the smoothness of her calves flexing in her hose. She was busy. She stood over her desk, reading the notations on the jacket, tapping a pencil on a pad. "I'd like to see you again," I said. She looked up. Her face was solemn. She stepped around her desk and reached past me with one hand to close the door. She spoke immediately. "I don't think that's a very good idea. Not now. It's not right for me now, Rusty." Then she opened up the door. She went back behind her desk. She worked. She turned to flip on the radio. She did not glance toward the place where I remained another moment. I do not think I believed at any time that Carolyn Polhemus loved me. I thought only that I pleased her. My passion, my obsession flattered and enlarged her. And so I did not suffer rejection. I was not ravaged by grief. When it finally occurred to me that I might have a successor, I did not have fantasies of his destruction. I would have agreed to share. I was devastated by denial, by longing. I wanted simply what it was I'd had. I craved Carolyn and my release in her in a way that did not end. For me, it never ended. There was nothing to make it end. Her willingness had always been only secondary, convenient. I wanted my passion in its great, exultant moments, the burning achievement of my worship, of my thrall. To be without it was to be in some way dead. I longed. I longed. I sat up nights in my rocking chair, imagining Carolyn, overcome by pity for myself.
In those weeks, my life seemed to have exploded. My sense of proportion left me. My judgment took on the grotesque exaggerations of a cruel cartoon. A 14-year-old girl was abducted, stored like merchandise in a defendant's trunk, sodomized in one manner or another every hour or two for 3 days, and then was beaten by him, blinded so she could make no identification, and left for dead. I read reports about this case, attended meetings where the evidence was discussed. To myself, I thought, I hurt for Carolyn. At home, I made my absurd confession to Barbara, weeping at the dinner table, crying in my highball. Do I have the guts to say it? I wanted her sympathy. That mad, egoistic instinct naturally went to make my suffering worse. Barbara would not endure the sight of me in any visible pain. Now there was no place left. At work, I did nothing. I watched the hallways for some glimpse of Carolyn passing by. At home, my wife was now my warden, daring me with the threat of the imminent end of family life to wear any sign of neediness. I took to walks. December turned to January. The temperature sunk near zero and stayed that way for weeks. I trudged hours through our little town, with my scarf across my face, the fur trimming of my parka burning when it touched the exposed portion of my forehead and my cheeks. My own tundra. My Siberia. When would it end? I wanted simply to have, or if not to have, to find some peace. Carolyn avoided me. She was as artful at that as at so many other things. She sent me memos, left Eugenia phone messages. She did not go to meetings I was scheduled to attend. I'm sure I drove her to it, that in the moments when we caught sight of each other, she could see my pathetic, hungering expression. In March, I called her from home. It happened a few times. She had drafted an indictment in a recidivist case, complex charges with allegations going back to the 1960s. I told myself it would be easier to discuss involved legal problems without the interruptions of the office. I waited until Nat was asleep and Barbara was stowed in the closed womb of her study, from where I knew she could never hear me calling downstairs. Then I paged Carolyn's listing in the little mimeographed directory Mac put out, containing all the deputy's home phones. I hardly needed to look to recall the number, but I suppose that in those moments of compulsion I took some strange satisfaction from seeing her name in print. It prolonged, in a way, the communication. It meant my fantasy was real. As soon as I heard Carolyn's voice, I knew how false my excuses had been. I could not bring myself to utter a sound. Hello? Hello? I melted when I heard her speak in a tone without reproach. Who was it she was awaiting now? Each time I did it, I was sure that pride would bear my saying a word or two. I intricately plotted the conversations beforehand. Humorous cracks to dislodge her from indifference or chagrin. Sincere declarations for the instant when I was given half a chance. I could not make any of it take place. She answered, and I awaited in a fiery pit of shame. Tears came to my eyes. My heart felt squeezed. Hello? Hello? I was relieved when she slammed down the phone. When I quickly tucked the office directory into the hallway bureau. She knew, of course, that it was me. There was probably something forlorn and beseeching in my breathing. One Friday night, late in March, I sat in Gill's, finishing a drink I had started with Lapranzer before he headed home. I saw her staring at me in the long, beveled mirror behind the bar. Her face was there above the whiskey bottles. Her hair was newly done, shining and stiff beneath the spray. The anger in her look was cruel. Pretense was so much easier. I moved my glance from hers and told the bartender to give her an old-fashioned. She said no, but he did not hear her, and she waited until he brought the drink. She was standing, I was sitting. The burly Friday evening tumult of Gill's went on around us,
The juke was screaming and the laughter was wild. The atmosphere had the beefy smell of Fridays, the musk of sexuality unlimbering from the week's restraint. I finished my beer and finally, thank God, found the strength to speak. "I'm like a kid," I told her. I was talking without looking her way. "I'm so uncomfortable right now, just sitting here. I want to walk away. And most of the time, the only thing I think I want in life is to talk to you." I looked up to see how she was taking this and found her expression largely abstracted. "That's what I've been doing for months now, walking past you. That's not cool, is it?" "It's safe," she said. "It's not cool," I repeated. "But I'm inexperienced. I mean, I want to have this war-weary, so-what thing about it all, but I'm not making it, Carolyn. I got engaged when I was 22 years old, and right before the wedding I did my time in the reserves, and I got drunk and screwed some woman in a station wagon behind a bar. That's it," I said. "That's the history of my infidelities, my life of wild amours. I'm dying," I said, "right this minute. Sitting on this fucking bar stool, I am just about dead. You like that? I'm shaking. My heart is hammering. In a minute, I'll need air. That's not very cool, is it?" "And what do you want from me, Rusty?" It was her turn now, looking dead into the mirror. "Something," I said. "Advice? If that's all I can get." She put her drink down on the bar. She put her hand down on my shoulder. She looked straight at me for the first time. "Grow up," she said, and walked away. "And for a minute then," I said to Robinson, "I felt the most desperate wish that she were dead." Chapter 17. Around the office, Tommy Molto was nicknamed the Mad Monk. He is a former seminarian, 5'6", if he is lucky, 40 or 50 pounds overweight, badly pockmarked, nails bitten to the quick. A driven personality. The kind to stay up all night working on a brief, to go 3 months without taking off a weekend. A capable attorney, but he is burdened by a zealot's poverty of judgment. As a prosecutor, he always seemed to me to be trying to make facts rather than to understand them. He burns at too high a temperature to be worth much before a jury. But he made a good assistant to Nico. He has qualities of discipline that DeLaGuardia lacks. He and DeLay go all the way back to grade school at St. Joe's, Dago Society. Molto's one of the guys who were included before they were old enough to worry about who was cool. Tommy's personal life is a cipher. He is single, and I've never seen him with a woman, which inspires the usual conjecture. But if I were to guess, I'd imagine he's still celibate. That singular intensity seems to have a subterranean source. Tommy, as usual, is whispering to Nico hotly when I come through the reception room. There's been a lot of rubbernecking in the office, file clerks and secretaries rushing to the receptionist's window to see what the new boss looks like, as if they could have forgotten in 9 months. The TV crews followed Nico up there and did their takes of Nico and Tommy sitting in hard wooden chairs, waiting to meet with Horgan. But that is over now. The reporters have dispersed, and the two of them actually look somewhat forlorn when I come by. Nico does not even have his flower. I cannot resist giving it to Molto. "Tommy Molto," I say. "We once had a guy of that name who worked here, but we think he might be dead. Keep those calls and letters coming, Tom." This joshing, which I intend in all good humor, seems not merely to fall flat, but to inspire a look of horror. Molto's heavy brows knit, and he actually appears to recoil when I offer my hand. I try to ease the moment by turning to DeLay. He takes my hand, although he, too, seems somewhat reluctant to accept my congratulations. "I will never say you did not tell me so," I admit. Nico does not smile. In fact, he looks the other way. He is extremely ill at ease. I do not know if the campaign has left a wake of bitterness, or if DeLay, like so many of us, is simply scared to death now that he finally has what he so long wanted. One thing I am certain of after this encounter Nico will not be bidding to retain my services. I go so far as to call the file room and ask them to begin putting together some boxes. Late in the morning, I call a Pranzer's number at McGrath Hall. His phone, which is never answered when he's out, is picked up by someone whose voice I do not recognize. 34068? Dan LaPranzer? Not in. Who is this, please? When do you expect him? Who is this? No message, I say, before hanging up. I knock on the adjoining door to see what Mac makes of all this. She's gone. When I ask Eugenia where, she tells me that Mac is in Raymond's office, meeting, as she puts it, with Mr. Della Guardia. She has been there almost an hour. I stand next to Eugenia's desk, battling my own bitterness. All in all, this has not worked out. Nico is now Mr. Della Guardia. Mac is on his staff until she takes the bench. Raymond is going to get rich. Tommy Molto has my job. And I'll be lucky if next month I can pay the mortgage. I'm still standing by Eugenia when the phone rings. Mr. Horgan wants to see you, she says. In the face of all the stern rebukes I have given to myself while I was marching down the hallway, the juvenile rush of sensation I feel when I see Nico in the PA's chair astonishes me. I am immobilized by anger, jealousy, and revulsion. Nico has assumed a perfect proprietary air. He has removed his suit coat, and his face is gravely composed, an expression which I know Nico well enough to realize is completely affected. Tommy Molto is sitting beside him, his chair somehow dropped a few inches back into the room. It strikes me that Tommy has already mastered the art of being a toady. Raymond motions for me to sit. He says that this is really Nico's meeting now, so he offered him the chair. Raymond himself is standing up beside his sofa. Mac has her chair wheeled up to the window and is looking out. She still has not greeted me, and I realize now from her demeanor that Mac wants to be nowhere near this scene. The old saw, harder for her than for me. "We've made some decisions here," Raymond says. He turns to Della Guardia. Silence. Delay, in his first assignment as PA, is word-struck. "Well, perhaps I should explain this first part," Raymond says. He is extremely grim. I know his forced expression well enough to realize that he is angry and laboring to remain composed. You can tell, just from the atmosphere, that there were bruises raised during the preceding meeting. "I spoke last night with the mayor and told him that I had no desire to remain in office in light of the voters' preferences. He suggested to me that as long as I felt that way, that I ought to talk it over with Nico to see if he wants to come on early. He does. And so that's what's going to happen. With the county board's concurrence, I'll be leaving Friday." I can't help myself. "Friday? It's a little faster than I would have thought myself, but there are certain factors." Raymond stops. Something is precarious in his manner. He is struggling. Horgan straightens the papers on the coffee table. He drifts to the sideboard and looks for something else. He is having a miserable time. I decide to make it easy for everybody. "I'll be taking off then, too," I say. Nico starts to speak, and I interrupt. "You'll be better off with a fresh start, Delay." "That's not what I was going to say." He stands. "I want you to know why Raymond is leaving so soon. There's going to be a criminal investigation of his staff. We have information. Some of it came to us during the campaign, but we didn't want to get into that kind of gutter stuff. But we have information, and we think there's a serious problem." I am confused by Nico's apparent anger. I wonder if he is talking about the B file. Perhaps there is a reason for Molto's connection to that case. "Here, let me butt in," Raymond says. "Rusty, I think the best way to deal with this is to be direct. Nico and Tom have raised some questions with me about the Polhemus investigation. They're not confident in the way you've handled it, and I've agreed now to step aside. They can examine that question in any way they think is best. That's a matter for their professional judgment. But Max suggested, well, we all agreed, to make you aware of the situation." I wait. The sense of alarm spreads through me before the instant of comprehension. I am under criminal investigation? I laugh out loud. From across the room, Mac finally speaks. "'Tain't funny, McGee,' she says. There is no humor in her voice.
"'This,' I say, "'is a crock. What did I supposedly do?'
"'Rusty,' Raymond says. "'We do not need that kind of discussion now. Nico and Tom think that there are some things you should have spoken up about. That's all.'
"'That is not all,' Molto says suddenly. His look is piercing. I think you've been engaged in misdirection. Hide the ball, ring around the rosy for almost a month now. You've been covering your ass.
I think you're sick, I tell Tommy Molto. Mac has wheeled her chair about. We don't need this, she says. This discussion should take place somewhere else, with somebody else. The hell with that, I say. I want to know what this is about.
It's about, says Molto, the fact that you were in Carolyn's apartment the night she was killed.
My heart beats so hard that my vision shifts, jumps. I was waiting for someone to chastise me because I had an affair with the decedent. This is incomprehensible, and I say so. Ludicrous, bullshit. What was that? A Tuesday night? Barbara's at the U, and I was babysitting.
Rusty, says Raymond, my advice to you is to shut your fucking mouth.
Molto is on his feet. He is approaching me. Stalking. He is enraged.
We've got the print results. The ones you never could remember to ask for. And they're your prints on the glass. Yours, Rojat K. Savage. Right on that glass in the bar. 5 feet from where the woman was found dead. Maybe you didn't remember at first that all county employees get printed.
I stand.
This is absurd.
And the muds you told LaPranzer not to get? The ones from your house? We had the phone company pull them this morning. They're on the way down here right now. You were calling her all month. There's a call from your house to hers that night.
I think I've had enough of this, I say, if I can be excused. I have gotten as far as Loretta's little office outside Raymond's when Molto calls out behind me. He follows me into the anteroom. I can hear DeLaGuardia yelling Molto's name.
I want you to know one thing, Savage. He points his finger at me. I know.
Sure you do, I say.
We're going to have a warrant for your butt the first day we're here. You better get yourself a lawyer, man. A damn good one.
For your bullshit theory of an obstruction case? Molto's eyes are burning.
Don't pretend you don't get it. I know. You killed her. You're the guy.
Rage. As if my blood had quickened, as if my veins were filled only with that black poison. How old and familiar, how close to my being, it seems. I come near Tommy Molto. I whisper,
"Yeah, you're right,"
before I walk away.
Summer. Chapter 18.
The documents and reports are in the front. The witness statements are in the back, says Jamie Kemp as he sets a heavy cardboard box on the faultless finish of the walnut meeting table. We are in the small conference room in the offices of his employer, Alejandro Stern, my attorney. Kemp is sweating. He walked 2 blocks in the July sun from the county building with these papers. His navy tie has been pulled away from his collar, and some of his fancy blonde Prince Valiant hairdo, an affectation left over from his younger days, is matted to his temples. "I'm going to check my phone messages," Kemp says. "Then I'll be back to look at this stuff with you. And remember," Kemp points, "don't panic. Defense lawyers have a name for what you're feeling. They call it clong." What's clong? Clong is the rush of shit to your heart when you see the state's evidence. Kemp smiles. I'm glad he thinks I can still take a joke.
It is not fatal.
It is July 14th, 3 weeks since my indictment for murdering Carolyn Polhemus. Later this afternoon, I will appear before Chief Superior Court Judge Edgar Mumphrey for my arraignment. Under state statutes governing discovery in criminal cases, the prosecution is required, prior to arraignment, to make available to the defense all physical evidence they intend to introduce,
and a list of witnesses, including copies of their statements. Thus, this box. I stare at the familiar label applied to the cardboard. People versus Rojat K. Savage. I'm full of that feeling again. This hasn't happened. Alone in this comfortable room with its dark wainscoting and rows of crimson-jacketed law books, I wait for this now familiar adhesion of dread and longing to pass. There is another copy of the indictment in the front of the box. I always focus on the same words, trespass with force and arms, trespass vi et armis, a term of the common law. With these same words, for centuries, persons in the English-speaking countries were accused of acts of violence. The phrase is archaic, long abandoned in most jurisdictions, but it is part of the text of our state statute, and reading it here always leaves me with the sense of a bizarre heritage. I have made league with the all-stars of crime, John Dillinger, Bluebeard, Jack the Ripper, and the million lesser lights, the half-mad, the abused, the idly evil, and the many who surrendered to a moment's terrible temptation, to an instant when they found themselves well acquainted with our wilder elements, our darker side. After 2 months of daily press leaks, of rumor, innuendo, cruel gossip, I said resolutely that it would be a relief if an indictment finally came down. I was wrong. The day before, Delay sent Stern what is called the defendant's courtesy copy. I first read the charges about 40 feet from here, down the hall in Sandy's tasteful cream-colored office, and my heart and all my other organs were at once all stalled, and so full of pain that I was certain that something in those regions must have burst. I could feel the blood gone from my face, and I knew that my panic was visible. I tried to sound composed, not to show courage, but because I suddenly realized it was simply the only alternative. Sandy was sitting beside me on the sofa, and to him I mentioned Kafka. "Does it sound horrible and try to say that I can't believe this?" I asked. "That I'm full of incomprehension and rage?" "Of course you cannot," said Sandy. "Of course not. I, who have practiced at the criminal bar for 30 years in this city, am not able to believe it. And by now I thought I had seen everything, everything. And I do not say that loosely. I had a client, Rusty, I cannot use a name, of course, who once placed $25 million in gold bullion in exactly the place that you are sitting, just the ingots, 2 feet high. And I, who have seen such things, I sit at home at night and think to myself, truly, this is remarkable and frightening." From Sandy, these words had a kind of reach, the span of authentic wisdom. There is, with his soft Spanish accent, an elegance to the sound of even his ordinary speech. His dignity is soothing. Over time, I have found that I hover, like a lover, on every courtly gesture. "Rusty," Sandy said to me, touching the page I held in my hand. "You make no mention of the only thing," he searched for a word, "which is encouraging." "What's that?" "No notice. No Section 5 notice." "Ah," I said, and a shiver passed through me. In our state, the prosecution must give notice at the time of indictment if it is seeking the death penalty. With all my finely calibrated calculations of Delay's intentions over the months, some zealous internal defense had prevented my mind from even lighting on that possibility. My look, I believe, revealed some of my embarrassment, even humiliation, that I was already so detached from routine professional perspectives. "I assumed," I said weakly.
"Ah, well," Sandy smiled gently, "we have these habits," he said.
At Sandy's advice, we were not in town when the indictment was returned. Barbara and Nat and I went to a cabin owned by friends of her parents up near Skagen. At night, you could hear the rushing of Crown Falls a mile away, and the trout fishing proved better than at any time I can recall. But, of course, the calamity 400 miles south was never out of mind. A day later, George Leonard from the Trib somehow got the number of the cabin and asked me for a comment. I referred him to Stern. Later, I came in to hear Barbara in conference with her mother. After she put down the phone, I asked, somehow feeling that I should, "It's all over?" "Everywhere. TV, both papers, front page, pictures. Your old office mate DeLay handed out every scummy detail." This proved to be an understatement. "My case is the stuff of supermarket tabloids. Chief prosecutor charged with murder, had affair with victim. Sex, politics, and violence mix in Kendall County. Not only was the local press full of this for days, but the national media, too. Out of curiosity, I began to read these accounts myself. The library in Nearing has an excellent periodical section, and I have little to do now during the days. On Stern's advice, I refused to resign as a deputy PA and was placed on an indefinite administrative leave with pay. As a result, I have spent more time in the library than I would have expected. I join the old men and the bag ladies in enjoying the silence and the air conditioning as I inspect these national reports of my misconduct. The New York Times was, as usual, dryly factual, referring to everyone as Mr. and laying out the entire antic circumstance. It was, surprisingly, the national news magazines, Time and Newsweek, that did their best to make it all seem lurid. Each article was accompanied by the same photo, taken by some asshole I saw lurking in the bushes for a couple of days. Stern finally advised me to walk outside and let him take his picture on the condition that he promised to beat it. That worked. The minicam units, which, according to the neighbors, were camped before the house for a week while we were hiding near Skagen, are yet to return. That makes little practical difference. After 12 years in which I sometimes prosecuted the biggest cases in town, the papers and TV stations had enough footage of me on file to put my face everywhere. I cannot walk around Nearing without enduring endless staring. There is now a permanent hesitation in everybody's manner, a few portions of a second lost before a greeting. The comments of solace that are made, which are few, are ludicrous and inept. My cleaner telling me, "Tough break," or the teenage gas station attendant asking if that's really me he's been reading about in the paper. Another thing I like about the library is that no one is allowed to talk. And how do I feel, so instantly struck low, brought down from my station as model citizen and become a pariah instead? To say that there are no words is inaccurate. There are words, but they would be so many. My spirits keel about wildly. The anxiety is corrosive, and I spend much time in a tumult of anger and disbelief. For the most part, there is a numbness, a sense of idle refuge. Even in my concern for Nat and how all of this will warp his future, the dawning thought is that it has happened, ultimately, just to me. I alone am the foremost victim, and to some extent I can endure that. I acquired more of my father's fatalism than I expected. A side of me has always been without faith in reason or in order. Life is simply experience. For reasons not readily discerned, we attempt to go on. At instants, I am amazed that I am here. I have taken to watching my shoes as I cross the pavement, for the fact that I am moving, that I am going anywhere, doing anything, strikes me, at odd moments, as amazing. That in the midst of this misfortune, life continues, seems bizarre. And mostly I am like this, floating and remote. Of course, a great deal of the time is also spent wondering why this has occurred. But I find that at some point along the way, my ability to assay ceases. My speculation seems to lead to a dark and frightening periphery, the edge of a black vortex of paranoia and rage from which, thus far, I have instantly withdrawn. I know that on some levels I cannot take much more, and I simply do not. I worry instead about when it will be over and what the result will be. I want, with a desperation whose size cannot be encompassed by metaphor, I want all of this never to have taken place. I want things to be as they were before, before I allowed my life to be ransacked by Carolyn, and everything that followed. And then there is my consuming anxiety for Nat. What will happen to him? How can he be sheltered? How can I protect him from shame? How can I have brought him to the brink of being, for all purposes, half an orphan? These are in some ways my worst moments. This raging, lashing frustration, this sense of incompetence, these tears. And then, once or twice in the last weeks, an extraordinary feeling, lighter than air, more soothing than a breeze, a hope that seems to settle in without accounting, and which leaves me with the sense that I have mounted some high rampart and have the courage simply to look ahead. The case against me, as I assess it from the contents of the cardboard box, is straightforward. Nico has listed about a dozen witnesses of substance, more than half of them related to the physical and scientific evidence he plans to introduce. LaPranzer will be called, apparently to say I instructed him not to subpoena my home phone tolls. Mrs. Kropotnik has identified me as someone she saw in Carolyn's building, although she is not positive I am the stranger she observed on the night of the murder. Also listed is a maid from Nearing, whose somewhat cryptic statement suggests that she saw me on the Nearing City bus one night close to the time Carolyn was killed. Raymond Horgan is named, Tommy Molto, Eugenia, my secretary, Robinson, the psychiatrist I saw on a few occasions, and a number of scientific experts, including Painless Kumagai. Nonetheless, this is clearly a circumstantial case. No one will say they saw me kill Carolyn Polhemus. No one will testify to my confession, if you do not consider Molto, whose file memorandum pretends to treat my last remark to him that Wednesday in April as if it was not rendered in a get-screwed tone. The heart of this case is the physical evidence. The glass, with two of my fingerprints, identified from the knowns I gave a dozen years ago when I became a deputy PA, the telephone mud records showing a call from my house to Carolyn's about an hour and a half before her murder, the vaginal smear revealing the presence within Carolyn's genitalia of spermatozoa of my blood type, thwarted in their urgent blind migration by a contraceptive compound whose presence implies a consensual sex act, and finally the malt-colored Zorak 5 fibers found on Carolyn's clothing and her corpse, and strewn about the living area, which match samples taken from the carpeting in my home. These last two pieces of evidence were developed as the result of a visit to my house by three state troopers, which took place a day or two after the Black Wednesday meeting, as Barbara and I now refer to it, in Raymond's office. The doorbell rang, and there was Tom Nislensky, who has served subpoenas for the PA's office for at least 6 years. I was still sufficiently unfocused that my initial reaction was to be mildly pleased to see him. "I don't like to be here," he said. He then handed me two grand jury subpoenas, one to produce physical evidence, a blood specimen, and one to testify. He also had a search warrant, narrowly drawn, which authorized the troopers to take samples of the carpeting throughout my home, as well as every piece of exterior clothing I owned. Barbara and I sat there in our living room, as three men in brown uniforms walked from room to room with plastic bags and scissors. They spent an hour in my closet, cutting tiny swatches from the seams. Nico and Molto had been clever enough not to search for the murder weapon, too. A law enforcement professional would know better than to keep the thing around, and if the troopers searched for it, the prosecutors would have to admit in court that it could not be found. "Is the stuff in here called Zorak 5? I asked Barbara quietly while the troopers were upstairs. "I don't know what it is, Rusty." Barbara, as usual, seemed to be placing a premium on maintaining her composure. She had a little pursed-up expression, peeved but no worse, as if they were 14-year-olds setting off firecrackers too late at night. "Is it synthetic?" I asked. "Do you think we could afford wool?" she replied. I called Stern, who had me make an inventory of what they took. The next day, I voluntarily provided a blood sample downtown. But I never testified. Stern and I had our one serious dispute about that. Sandy repeated the accepted wisdom that an investigation target accomplishes nothing by pretrial statements except to prepare the prosecutor for the defense. In his own gentle way, Stern reminded me of the damage I had already done with my outburst in Raymond's office. But in late April, unindicted and convinced I never would be charged, my goal was to prevent this mad episode from damaging my reputation. If I took five and refused to testify, as I had the right to do, it would probably never reach the papers. But every lawyer in the PA's office would know, and through them, half the others on the street. Sandy prevailed when the results of the blood test came back and identified me as a secretor. That is, someone who produced A-type antibodies, just like the man who had last been with Carolyn. The chances of this being a coincidence were about 1 in 10. I realized then that my last opportunity for quick exoneration had passed. Tommy Molto refused to accept any substitute for my assertion of the privilege, and so one bleak afternoon in May, I, like so many others I had often ridiculed, snuck into the grand jury room, a little windowless chamber that looks something like a small theater, and repeated in response to 36 different questions, "On the advice of my attorney, I will decline to answer because it may tend to incriminate me." "So," says Sandy Stern, "how do you enjoy seeing the world from the other side?" Engrossed in mysteries of the cardboard box, I did not notice him enter the conference room. He stands, with one hand on the door handle, a short, roundish man in a flawless suit. There are just a few stray hairs that cross his shining, pale scalp, emanating from what was once a widow's peak. Tucked between the fingers is a cigar. This is a habit which Stern indulges only in the office. It would be uncivil in a public place, and Clara, his wife, forbids it at home. "I didn't expect you back so soon," I tell him. "Judge Magnuson's calendar is dreadful. Naturally, the sentencing will be called last." He is referring to another case on which he has been engaged. Apparently, he has spent a good deal of time waiting in court, and the matter is not yet concluded. "Rusty, would you mind terribly if Jamie appears with you at the arraignment?" He begins to explain at length, but I interrupt. "No problem. You are very kind. Perhaps then we can take a few moments with what your friend Delaguardia has sent over. What is it you call him?"
"Delay."
Sandy's consternation is apparent. He cannot figure out the reason for the nickname, and he is too gentlemanly to ask me to reveal even the most trivial confidence of the PA's office, with which he is so often a contestant. He removes his coat and calls for coffee. His secretary brings it, and a large crystal ashtray for his cigar.
"So," he says, "do we now understand Delaguardia's case?"
"I think I do."
"Fine, then. Let me hear it. 30-second summation, if you please, of Nico's opening statement."
When I retained Sandy, within 3 or 4 hours of that bizarre meeting in Raymond's office, we spent 30 minutes together. He told me what it would cost, a $25,000 retainer, against a fee to be billed at $150 an hour for time out of court, and $300 an hour in, the balance, strictly as a courtesy to me, to be returned if there was no indictment. He told me not to talk to anyone about the charges, and in particular to make no more outraged speeches to prosecutors. He told me to avoid reporters and not to quit my job. He told me this was frightening, reminiscent of the scenes of his childhood in Latin America. He told me that he was confident that with my extraordinary background, this entire matter would be favorably resolved. But Sandy Stern, with whom I have done business for better than a decade, against whom I have tried 6 cases, and who on matters of gravity or of little consequence has always known that he could accept my word, Sandy Stern has never asked me if I did it. He has inquired from time to time about details. He asked me once, quite unceremoniously, whether I'd had a physical relationship with Carolyn, and I told him without flinching, yes. But Stern has remained far clear of ever putting the ultimate question. In that, he is like everybody else. Even Barbara, who evinces by various proclamations a belief in my innocence, has never asked me directly. People tell you it's tough. They cling, or more often seem visibly repulsed. But nobody has sufficient sand to come out with the only question you know they have in mind. From Sandy, this indirection seems more of his classical manner, the formal presence that lies over him like brocaded drapes. But I know it serves for more. Perhaps he does not ask because he is not certain of the verity of the answer he may get. It is a given of the criminal justice system, an axiom as certain as the laws of gravity, that defendants rarely tell the truth. Cops and prosecutors, defense lawyers and judges, everybody knows they lie. They lie solemnly, with sweaty palms and shifty eyes, or more often with a look of schoolboy innocence and an incensed disbelief when their credulity is assailed. They lie to protect themselves. They lie to protect their friends. They lie for the fun of it, or because that is the way they have always been. They lie about big details and small ones, about who started it, who thought of it, who did it, and who was sorry. But they lie. It is the defendant's credo. Lie to the cops. Lie to your lawyer. Lie to the jury that tries your case. If convicted, lie to your probation officer. Lie to your bunkmate in the pen. Trumpet your innocence. Leave the dirty bastards out there with a grain of doubt. Something can always change. Thus it would be an act contrary to his professional acumen, were Sandy Stern to commit himself to an unreserved faith in everything I say. Instead, he does not ask. This procedure has one further virtue. If I were to meet any new evidence by frontally contradicting what I had told Sandy in the past, legal ethics might require him to withhold me from the witness stand, where I almost certainly intend to go. Better to see everything the prosecution has, to be certain that my recollection, as the lawyers put it, has been fully refreshed, before Sandy inquires about my version. Caught in a system where the client is inclined to lie and the lawyer who seeks his client's confidence may not help him do that, Stern works in the small open spaces which remain. Most of all, he desires to make an intelligent presentation. He does not wish to be misled or to have his options curbed by rash declarations that prove to be untrue. As the trial approaches, he will need to know more. He may ask the question then, and I certainly will tell him the answer. For the time being, Stern has found, as usual, the most artful and indefinite means by which to probe. Delaguardia's theory is something like this, I say. Sabich is obsessed with Polhemus. He's calling her house, can't let go. He has to see her. One night, knowing that his wife will be going out and that he can get to Carolyn on the sneak, he calls up, begs to see her, and Polhemus finally agrees. She rolls around with him for auld lang syne, but then something goes wrong. Maybe Sabich is jealous of another relationship. Maybe Carolyn says that this was merely the grand finale. Whatever it is, Sabich wants more than she will give. He blows a gasket. He gives her what for with some heavy instrument, and decides to make it look like rape. Sabich is a prosecutor. He knows that this way there will be dozens of other suspects. So he ties her up, opens the latches to make it look like somebody slipped in, and then, this is the diabolical part, pulls her diaphragm out of her, so there won't be any evidence of consent. Like all bad guys, of course, he makes a few mistakes. He forgets the drink he had when he came in, the glass he left on the bar, and he does not think, maybe even realize, that the forensic chemist will be able to ID the spermicide. But we know he did evil to this woman, because he never revealed, he lied, about his presence on the night of the murder, which is established by all the physical evidence. This exposition is eerily comforting to me. The heartless hip analysis of crime is so much a part of my life and my mentation that I cannot make myself sound ruffled or even feel a fragment of concern. The world of crime has its argot, as ruthless as the jazz man's is sweet. And speaking it again, I feel I am back among the living, among those who see evil as a familiar, if odious, phenomenon with which they have to deal, like the scientist studying diseases through his microscope. I go on. That's Nico's theory, something like that. He has to straddle a little bit on the question of premeditation. He might argue that Savage had it in mind to do her in from minute one, that he chose this night so he had an alibi, in case she refused to build the old fire anew. Maybe Savage was on a different trip. You can't live if you won't be mine. That'll depend on evidentiary nuances. Probably, Nico will give an opening that won't lock him in, but he'll be close to this. How does it sound? Sandy looks over his cigar. They're Cuban, he told me a few weeks ago. A former client gets them. He does not ask how. The wrapper, deep brown, burns so cleanly that you can see the leaf veins etched within the ash.
Plausible, he says at last. Evidence of motive is not strong here, and it is usually critical in a circumstantial case. Nothing ties you to any instrument of violence. The state is further disadvantaged because you were, in essence, a political opponent of De La Guardia. Never mind that you did not consider yourself a political employee. A jury will not believe that, and for our purposes, should not be told that. There is additional evidence of bad feeling between you and the prosecuting attorney, inasmuch as you personally fired him from his post. The importance of these matters, however, could be greatly reduced if the prosecuting attorney himself did not try this case.
Forget that, I say. Nico would never move out of the spotlight. Stern seems to smile as he draws on the cigar.
I quite agree. So we will have those advantages. And these factors, which would raise questions in the mind of any reasonable person, will take on large importance in a circumstantial case, from which you and I both know juries are disinclined.